when she was around 15 months old. I was taking her in for her well checks, and her pediatrician took a look at her growth chart, and she had been kind of hinting that there was, that she was concerned about Katie's growth pattern.
Genetics isn't always black and white, and the emotions and decisions surrounding genetics and genetic testing can be even more complex. Welcome to Patient Stories with Gray Genetics. I'm Eleanor Griffith, certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, an independent telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service. It seems like there are constantly headlines in the news about genetics, but few news stories focus on the patient experience. At Gray Genetics, we are collecting patient stories, your stories. Every other Tuesday, we bring you a patient story related to genetics. If you'd like to share your story, send an email to podcast@graygenetics.com.
But I was just kind of, again, in that mindset of, I've got to let this stuff go because I don't want to overanalyze and overthink these things. And so I just kind of let it go until that 15-month well check, and the pediatrician was like, she's really small. She's 15 months old and the size of a 6-month-old. This is not normal.
On our last episode, I spoke with Jill Fortreed about her oldest son, Alex, who lived just 10 months. In today's episode, Jill shares the story of her youngest daughter, Katie. When we recorded this interview in 2021, Katie was 5 years old and had a suspected diagnosis of Russell-Silver syndrome. At the end of the episode, we'll share Jill's update on Katie.
So Alex was your first child, and you now have 4 living children.
Yes.
And your youngest daughter has a diagnosis of Russell-Silver syndrome.
Yes.
How did you get that diagnosis? And I'm wondering how your experience of with Alex has informed your experience with your other children and then with other genetic diagnosis for your youngest daughter.
Right.
Katie.
So, to kind of answer your second question first, when my husband and I found out we were pregnant with our oldest daughter, we originally had plans, even before that, let me back up a little bit before that even, before we even got pregnant with her, we wanted to talk to the geneticist that dealt with Alex and kind of get his opinion on whether or not we would have a chance of having another child with any type of issues, genetic issues. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of ironic given our youngest daughter. But he told us at the time that given my age and given everything else about my history, that there was less than a 1% chance of us having another child with a significant chromosomal issue. And so he was really lumping all the chromosomal issues together at that point. And so we went ahead and we decided, okay, we'll try to get pregnant. Once we got pregnant, we had originally said, okay, we're going to do all of the testing just so that we know. You know, so if there is something going on, we can know and be prepared. She had other plans because yeah. When we went in to do the quad screening with her, and the doctor was trying to, or no, it wasn't even the quad screening. We had opted to have an amniocentesis. And when the doctor went in to draw the amniotic fluid, she kept stretching and taking away the pockets of amniotic fluid that he was trying to draw from. and so he wasn't able to get any fluid to do the testing. And so my husband and I talked about it in the 4 weeks in between our appointments and decided that, you know what, we're okay with not knowing. And so we opted actually not to do any prenatal screenings with any of our children. We figured what's going to happen is what's going to happen. And no matter what happens, we were going to love our children and take care of them for as long as we have them.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you went from, obviously we'll do all the testing possible just to know, to actually no testing for any of the children.
Yeah.
What was that? What was that process like? Was that hard for you? Were you immediately on the same page? Or was it kind of like that one experience with trying to do an amniocentesis just kind of tipped you over to never mind about testing?
I think it was a little bit of all of that. Like, I went back and forth. Like, I wavered on it. Mm-hmm. From my husband's point of view, it was the risk factor for me and for the baby that really kind of made him pause. Then as we talked it over, I really kind of came around to his way of thinking. And the testing wouldn't have changed anything. We would have been in the same position, you know, no matter what the results came back with. So
he would have continued with the pregnancy.
Right.
Regardless.
Exactly. And so it didn't change anything. And so with the risks and knowing that nothing was going to change, in our end goal, of keeping the baby, we figured it wasn't worth the risk. Mm-hmm. Even for that peace of mind of knowing. I will say that one of the hardest things to deal with, after Alex was the overarching anxiety that kind of lives in the back of my mind of when is the other shoe going to drop? When is this going to turn from a healthy child or a healthy experience with this child or this baby or this pregnancy to something is going wrong? And that anxiety lived in the back of my mind, really until we got the diagnosis with Katie, my youngest daughter. Just of waiting for something bad to happen, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I tried not to let that overtake my life, but it was very rough, especially because Alex passed away at 10 months. In the first 10 months of all of my children's lives, waiting for that 10-month mark, I always felt like with them that once I got past that 10-month mark, I was golden, if that makes any mm-hmm. sense.
Completely.
I know logically it's, you know, anything could happen, but in my mind, that 10-month mark was the magic mark, kind of like with my three full-term pregnancies, the 36-week mark was the magic mark to get to, mm-hmm. because I didn't get to the 36-week mark with Alex or with my oldest daughter. So it was always kind of a waiting game.
That's a very long time to live with that anxiety, even if it's low level with like multiple children.
It is a very, very long time. And it was exhausting, mm-hmm. because I was constantly having to fight against that nature of wanting to make sure everything was 100% okay and thinking something was wrong and kind of letting things go. Which kind of leads me right into how we got the diagnosis with Katie. So she was born full term, but she was 5 pounds, 14 ounces at birth. Now I do have to go back and say that, it was a planned C-section for her. And so I went in, No, I take that back. It was supposed to be a planned C-section, but I ended up having my water break with her.
Okay.
But it was, I was full term when my water broke with her. And I delivered her at a very small hospital. And so when I got there, they only had, they had limited operating staff and limited staff to be able to work in the delivery operating room. And so they had had previous surgery scheduled at that hospital, and they didn't have enough staff. And so they decided that mine was not an emergency situation. Yes, my water had broke, but they were still going to deliver the baby within that 24-hour time frame. Mm-hmm. And I will say that Katie is my only child that I did not find out the gender before I had her. So at this point in time, we didn't know if it was a boy or a girl. So I went in, I think we got to the hospital around 8 in the morning, and they put me on IV fluids immediately. But I didn't actually deliver her until after 2.
Okay.
So if you think about all of that IV fluid going into my body and then going into her body, she had a lot of water weight added on to her. Because one of the hallmarks of Russell Silver syndrome is that they have an abnormally low birth weight. And she really didn't meet that criteria for the clinical diagnosis until you look back and you see, oh, I was on IV fluids for quite a long time before I delivered her. Mm. And luckily, the endocrinologist that we saw, he actually took that into consideration and decided that that was probably a valid reasoning. So she was born small, and she was normal or healthy otherwise. She had a lip tie and tongue tie, which we got revised, and some feeding issues because of that, but we got that revised and things kind of evened out. When she was around 15 months old, I was taking her in for her well checks, and her pediatrician took a look at her growth chart, and she had been kind of hinting that she was concerned about Katie's growth pattern. But I was just kind of, again, in that mindset of, I've got to let this stuff go because I don't want to overanalyze and overthink these things. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of let it go. Until that 15 month well check, and the pediatrician was like, she's really small. she's 15 months old and the size of a 6 month old. This is not normal.
Yeah.
And so, she sent us to a geneticist. It just so happened to be the same geneticist that we talked about, that saw Alex and that we talked to before we got pregnant with our oldest daughter. And also put in then for a referral for an endocrinologist, not because of anything that she suspected with an endocrine issue, but because she, Katie had had some blood drawn and it came back as low vitamin D, and she was already on a supplement. And so her pediatrician was kind of concerned. Mm-hmm. And it actually turns out that's a good thing because it took 3 months to get into the endocrinologist. So first we went to see the geneticist, and he was concerned, but the first thing he did is, okay, let's see if we can get her to kind of gain some weight because she's really thin. And so we got her on a regimen of Pediasure and counting her calories to make sure that we were giving her the right amount of calories for her age. And it helped a little. It filled her out a little bit. And then we went back to see him 3 months later. And it filled her out a little bit. But originally we were just supposed to see the geneticist nurse practitioner. And he wasn't supposed to actually see her that day, but thankfully, I, you know, with two older children than Katie, who had just gone through potty training, the younger of the two, they needed to go to the bathroom. And so the nurse practitioner very kindly offered to watch Katie as I took the older two into the bathroom. And so she was walking Katie up and down the hallway. And it just so happens that the geneticist saw her walking Katie up and down the hallway. And when I came out of the bathroom, the nurse practitioner's like, you need to go back in the room. The doctor wants to talk to you. And so I go in and I'm like, oh, what now? You know, that worry immediately started building up. And so he comes in carrying a medical textbook. And he goes, I saw her walking in the hallway and I immediately knew what she had. And so he takes the medical book, he opens it up to the page, and he goes, who does that look like? And he points to this picture, this case study picture. And I looked at it and I kind of looked over at Katie and I was like, well, kind of looks like Katie. I know it's not Katie, but that looks like Katie. And so he gave us the initial prognosis of, or diagnosis rather, of Russell-Silver syndrome. And so Russell-Silver syndrome, for those who may not know, is it's actually a type of dwarfism. But it's not like the little people, big world, where it's disproportionate smallness. It's all like her entire body is proportionally small. The statistics are without medicine, without medical intervention, children with Russell-Silver syndrome or adults who have it that were not treated medically, the average size for a woman with Russell-Silver that was not treated is around, I believe, 4 foot. So it is, I think most people would, when they think of like pygmies, would almost think of Russell-Silver syndrome, non-treated Russell-Silver syndrome kiddos and adults would be like the pygmies. What most people would think of as pygmies. So the geneticist at that point in time was like, okay, you need to see an endocrinologist. And I was like, well, we just so happen to have an appointment tomorrow to see this endocrinologist who happened to be in the same office as the geneticist. And so we went into that appointment and he had requested blood to be drawn before our appointment. And we went in and wouldn't you know, her vitamin D levels were normal. But yet now we have this other thing that we needed to talk about. And so we talked about it and he decided to not do a genetic test at that time. But he clinically diagnosed her. And so I mentioned in my email that there are several points that need to be met for a clinical diagnosis, one of which is birth weight and birth length. It has to be under a certain number for them to qualify. And as I mentioned earlier, this endocrinologist was very, very good about being willing to look at not only my, you know, not only her birth weight by itself, but then also the surrounding issues of me being on IV fluid for so long. Facial structure is another thing that they look for, because Russell-Silver kids have a higher forehead, a triangular shaped face, almost elvish is what it's sometimes called. Low muscle tone, and so they tend to walk later and have other issues. I will say we are very fortunate because she has she does not have some of the more dangerous aspects of Russell-Silver. Some kiddos end up with having extremely low blood sugar. And so they basically have to almost eat like several hours, like wake up in the night and eat just so that their blood sugar does not drop too low, which comes with a whole host of other issues, especially if surgery is required, because they can't go without food for that long and be healthy for surgery. But we are lucky that Katie does not have those issues. She's never been at risk for ketogenic shock or anything like that. So we're very, very fortunate. So it was a whirlwind of trying to get this diagnosis. And we were told, she was about a year and a half old when this happened. And we were told that the best course of action is to get her on human growth hormone. And so again, the doctor's office was wonderful because they actually had somebody in their office, they actually have somebody in their office who actually goes through the process of working with the insurance companies and doing all of the paperwork of resubmitting claims and resubmitting requests for coverage, so that the parents don't have to do that. Because the big thing about human growth hormone is that it is expensive, and a lot of insurance companies will not cover it.
Is that true? Do you know, even with a diagnosis of Russell-Silver syndrome, like, are there certain diagnoses where all of a sudden the coverage is easier or not necessarily?
Well, the problem is that it had been decided at some point in time that the best way to figure out if this was a true diagnosis is to go through a blood draw where the child is not allowed to eat. And I can't remember what it's called, but it's a very extensive, like, it's several hours long, and they, like, every hour are given a shot, and then their blood is drawn to check the levels. And it sounds horrendous.
Yeah. Something you wouldn't want to put your kid through.
Right. And most insurance companies, my understanding at least, is that most insurance companies require that, testing to be done before they will even consider a human growth hormone. Okay. Especially if the human growth hormone levels are normal, which for some Russell Silver kids, it is normal with just a normal blood draw. My understanding is this very, very tough. My insurance, I am forever grateful for my husband's company, because he gets great insurance through them. And they have done a lot to cover our family through Alex and everything. Because the only thing we had to do was wait until she was two. Because there's no studies out there saying that growth hormone helps kids younger than the age of two. Okay. And so as soon as she turned two, they resubmitted the claim and they approved it. And we started getting the human growth hormone. And that is a shot that she has to take every night before bed. And she will have to take that until she is around 14 or 15, whenever she basically goes through puberty. And so we are very, very, again, very fortunate, because we didn't have to jump through a lot of the hoops that a lot of other families that have kiddos with RSS have. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is that it's not a life-threatening condition. Because kids who aren't treated with human growth hormone, who have RSS, can still live full lives. They can still grow up, get married, have jobs. You know, things are more difficult because of their small stature, but it doesn't really change overall their quality of life much. And so I think that's part of the reason why it's so hard to get the human growth hormone approved for use. But so she's been on human growth hormone since she was around 2 years old. And she has now caught up with her age mates in terms of her size and her growth. She's still on the lower end, but all of my kiddos, except for my youngest child, my son, have been on the small side. So they're all very tiny. And so even though she's on the smaller side of her peers, in terms of like percentile, she is out now actually caught up, and is very solidly in, I think, the 25th percentile is what she was at her last well check.
And she's 5 years old now?
And she's 5 years old now. Yes.
Okay.
And, she wasn't even on the charts when she was 15 months old. Another good thing is that we started her early enough that she is on lower doses than what, some kiddos who start on human growth hormone are, because the later you start it, the higher the dose has to be to get you caught up. But because we started it when she was two, we've only increased the dose every 6 months. We've increased it by just 0.1. And so she started out at like 0.4 milligrams and now she's up to 0.9. And so it has been a very small incremental changes, versus I know kids who have been diagnosed at 8, you know, 7 or 8, who have had to have a lot more of that initially. The dose had to be a lot more initially. And every time they increased it, they increased it more. Mm-hmm. So we have been very, very fortunate in those terms because of all of that.
When you met with the geneticist, you already, when you actually had your formal appointment with the geneticist, you'd already kind of informally been given this diagnosis. Is that right?
When we met with the endocrinologist, we had been informally given the diagnosis, yes.
Okay.
The geneticist is the one who pinpointed it. And again, he basically saw the shape of her face and kind of the way she walked, because she did walk late because of low muscle tone. And so he kind of took all of that together and pieced it together and recognized it as Russell Silver.
What did he tell you at the time that would mean for her? Or did he give you like a broad range of possibilities? Like, how were you hearing at that time that?
So he really didn't give us much information. He was, like I said, he wasn't initially supposed to meet with her. And so he had other appointments that he kind of had to go to. But he was comfortable with leaving it at that, since we had an appointment with the endocrinologist the next day.
Okay.
And so the endocrinologist, when we talked with him, he is the one who said, you know, this is not something that is like dangerous. She's going to be fine. Like, even if for whatever reason you don't put her on the growth hormone, she's going to be fine. Like, he pretty much was like, yes, this is going to be a change, and there are things that you have to look for, but it's going to be fine and she's going to be fine. One of the big things is that because the body tries to focus on the growth and keeping the brain growing, sometimes there are a lot of times developmental delays with kiddos who have RSS, because their body is so focused on growing and keeping them at that healthy size that they should be, that the portions of the brain that deal with development tend to kind of get neglected until there's a little bit more stability. And so she did have occupational and physical therapy that she did for a little bit. She has since graduated out of that for the time being. And she has had ongoing speech therapy since we got her diagnosis. We just recently got a diagnosis of her having something called a vasopharyngeal insufficiency, which basically the soft palate in most people closes when you say certain sounds, and it closes off your nasal passage from your throat. Her soft palate isn't able to do that. And so she has a very nasally voice. She has trouble saying the harder sounds that require a cutoff from your nose, from your nasal passages. And so, and again, it is not common, but it is not, but there's a statistical amount of RSS kiddos who have a VPI. And so it's not out of the norm for these types of kiddos to have this issue. And what kind of made it worse in a way is that she had had her adenoids removed about a year and a half ago, I believe. She had had her adenoids removed because she had shallow breathing. And so they removed her adenoids. And by removing her adenoids, it took away some of the blockage that was helping her to be able to say some of those sounds. And so her speech kind of went downhill a little bit. It's hard to tell, really, because she wasn't speaking very much before that surgery. And then afterwards, she kind of had a language explosion and she started talking a lot more. So whether or not if she still had her adenoids, if she would still have these unclear speech issues, we're not sure. But it is what it is. So there's not much that we can do about it post-surgery. So she is going to have surgery to repair or to elongate the palate. It's the same surgery that doctors will do for those who have a cleft palate, even though she does not have a cleft palate. And it is going to, there's an 80% chance of it being successful and allowing her to speak normally. Right now she has a, speech and language device. It's an iPad that has a, program on it that allows her to find words and so that she's able to make herself understood. But she has trouble because if she doesn't know where a word is and I can't understand her, it's very frustrating for her to not be able to make herself understood. So we are hopeful that this surgery accomplishes what we're hoping it does. So
is that a surgery she'll be having soon?
Yes, she's actually going to be having it, fairly soon in about, a little under a month is when it's scheduled.
Yeah.
We had to make sure that she does not suck her thumb because, any type of pressure will damage the sutures. So that's one thing that we had to work very hard to get her to stop sucking her thumb. And we tried.
That's everything. A big lift for a five-year-old who.
Yeah. Well, we tried the nail polish. We tried, there are these thumb guards that you put on and it's supposed to help stop. But it didn't work with her because she is ridiculously smart. And she learned how to finagle her thumbs out of them. Uh-huh. So those didn't work. And so we ended up having to put an orthodontic device in her mouth. It's called a thumb crib. And it keeps the input of sucking her thumb away from her because it doesn't allow her to create that suction. But it also would kind of poke her, not in a hurtful way, but kind of just like poke her finger to remind her, oh, I can't put my thumb in my mouth. I can't suck my thumb. So we had that over the last couple of months. She removed it herself. but I have not seen any sign of her sucking her thumb. So I'm really hopeful that this surgery is going to be able to go through as planned. Nervous, but hopeful.
Yeah. How does at five, how does she feel about this? What is her understanding?
Oh, she is not looking forward to it. She is scared, understandably so. Like I said, she is very smart. All of my kids are very smart. One of the big discrepancies, though, is because she does have trouble communicating. A lot of people kind of discount her. Even I sometimes discount her because it's hard. But she's very smart and she understands a lot. And so we've explained it to her. Hey, this is going to help you talk. You want to be able to talk better. This will help you. She's still scared, and which I get. I mean, I can't fault her for that. I know anytime I've gone into surgery, it has been terrifying. So, and I'm an adult. So as a 5-year-old, I can't imagine how scared she is. I think once the surgery happens, I think, and she does her recovery and she starts doing the speech therapy to work with her, I am hopeful that things are going to kind of come quick to her because she knows the sounds that she should be making. She just physically can't make them. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that once she starts to see progress in the speech therapy realm, that she will recognize that the surgery was worth it. But it's hard to tell a 5-year-old that, trust me, this is going to be worth it. Cause
think about the long term to a 5-year-old.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's hard to make her understand that because there are teenagers who don't understand that concept of it's worth it in the end. So it's a little difficult trying to get her to recognize that this is something, and she's been very scared about people looking in her mouth because she's not, she doesn't want the surgery to happen. Overall though, I mean, she's taking it about as, I think, better than what I think I would have expected her to. So I think that helps. And I did tell her the other day that, hey, I'm going to be with you. Like, you get back to your room, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to be staying with you. Cause the hospital has opened up, parents being able to stay with their kiddos again. So I'm going to be with you. Like, I don't plan on leaving your side. I'm going to be with you this entire time, kiddo. And so that, I think, helped her a little bit to be comfortable, to be a little bit more, calm about it, kind of calmed her down. And of course my older two daughters, they have very big hearts and they're very concerned about her being scared and her having this surgery. So they're good kids and are going to help take care of her, I know. The recovery is going to be rough because it's going to be 4 months of my husband and I having to, if she's going to be eating with a spoon, we have to spoon feed her so that she doesn't put any pressure on the roof of her mouth. Basically all mechanically soft foods is what she has to eat. So there's going to be a lot of applesauce, a lot of pudding, mm-hmm. a lot of Jell-O, a lot of mashed potatoes. Because she can't eat the chips and the sandwiches and that kind of stuff that she would normally eat. So it's going to be a little bit rough going, but I think overall, I think it's going to be fine. And hopefully she falls in that 80% range versus the 20% range.
Yeah. What is it? You said 80% chance of it being successful. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Does successful look like being able to make those sounds that currently she can't make? And what is the 20% look like?
So,
or is there a bit of like an in-between?
Right. So, because hers is not caused by a physical issue, it's not because of a cleft palate. Hers is a muscle tone issue. And so, and to a small degree, the shape of her mouth is also affecting this, because her palate isn't quite long enough. But it's not because of a cleft palate or anything like that. So it's success would be that after therapy, after some amount of therapy, and really we don't know how much it's going to be, but after some amount of therapy, she will be able to make those harder sounds that, because you can build muscle over tone. So she could learn, you know, they could start training her mouth really on how to make those sounds, how to make that connection to block off the nasal passages. And her, the speech therapist that she has had, all of them have basically said, look, she knows these sounds. She knows what they're supposed to sound like. She knows how she's supposed to make them. And all of them have pretty much said, I don't think we're going to have an issue with her making these sounds eventually. They're going to, it's going to be a long road because she's going to have to learn and build up that muscle, but she is, she's not going to have the, she's not going to have to retrain her brain because her brain already knows how to make those sounds. Mm-hmm. The 20%, I think it may be a range of how well it works or not. Not really something we discussed with the surgeon. She does still have her communication device, and it is hers. And so we will be able to use that communication device if for some reason the surgery does not work, or it only works partially. She will still have that communication device to be able to communicate to people outside the family. So it's scary to think that I would be putting her through the pain of a surgery without the end result that we want. But on the other hand, I know that, as I've said several times before, she is a smart girl. She's going to be able to figure this out, and she is going to be able to figure out a way to work around the speech handicap that she would end up having if it did not work. And so I just have to keep that in mind that this is what we're working towards. And if it doesn't work, we're going to make it work together, because she's really a very big part of this. Like, she is, she's desperate to learn to read so that she can learn to spell, so that she can find the words on her device, on her speaking device, on her own, because I don't always know what she's saying. And so because she is so desperate to learn to read, like, she's going to be a success no matter what happens. She's going to be a success in this. And I just have to keep reminding myself of that fact, that she will be a success in this, but we are hoping again that she's a success and able to speak clearly.
Mm-hmm. And you have two older daughters, 9 and 7, and the younger son, 3, right?
That is correct, yeah.
How are they reacting to all of this?
So like I said earlier, my two older daughters, they have very big hearts, and they love their little sister, and they're very concerned about her having to have surgery. But they, for a 9 and a 7-year-old, they do very well in making sure that she's included, making sure that in general people aren't being mean to Katie because of her speech impediment, which is sometimes hard because they're 9 and 7. Mm-hmm. So they're very good about all of that. My son, he actually is in speech therapy as well, because he and Katie are the closest in age. He learned most of his speech patterns from her. Uh-huh. And so he does have, very similar sounding speech patterns. But his are due to more not being able to recognize the sounds. And again, it we've kind of tied it back to him learning to speak mostly from Katie. That kind of made it so he wasn't really able to recognize the sounds. So we're working We're working with speech therapist on that. He just aged out of the, he just aged out of First Steps, which is our state's free, or free or low cost, early childhood intervention program. I know most states have them. And it goes from birth to age three. And so he was in it for about 6 months before he aged out. So he doesn't really understand much about what's happening. And he's honestly, he's all boy. So I don't know if much of that would, I don't know if it would matter so much to him as a 3 year old boy. He just knows he gets to go and play every week with new friends. And that he and Katie have their own kind of language that they can communicate with each other with. So I think he enjoys that too.
Yeah. What else should I be asking you about Katie and her diagnosis of Russell Silver syndrome? And you haven't mentioned, for so many people with different diagnoses, patient support groups are a big factor. Has that been the case for you, or?
I tend to glean what information I can from support groups and then like not go back to them. just because I do have my own personal background, in terms of education. I was a biology teacher and I did kind of dabble with the idea of becoming a nurse for a short period of time. And of course, everything I went through with Alex, and now with Katie, I have a lot of medical knowledge that a lot of people don't, just enough to be dangerous. So I tend to, like I said, take what I need and then not really be involved. But there is a support group out there. It's called the Magic Foundation, and it is specifically for RSS and SGA, or small for gestational age, families. And so they have case studies, and they have case studies on their website. They have support groups. You can pay a small fee, and they will send you a physical copy of their, basically of the studies that have been done with Russell Silver kiddos and SGA kiddos, that, kind of some tips and some tricks of, okay, well, look for this and, get this test done if you see this type of scenario happening. And in fact, that's where I found the information of Russell Silver kids, there being a significant amount, statistically, of them having that, the mouth issue, the speaking issue that Katie has. Mm. And, because it was kind of mentioned to me by her speech therapist, and I came home and I looked it up and I was like, oh, look at this. Sure enough, it's in here. And so, that has been helpful because, like I said, it's been a way for me to kind of, navigate what we're going through with Katie and like being able to advocate for her. But at the same time, knowing that there are other people who have studied this and have done a better job than what I could do. And it is run by a woman who had a Russell Silver kiddo and then one of the top endocrinologists in the Russell Silver field. And they work very, very heavily with this endocrinologist to make sure that the information is accurate and up to date as possible. And they are the ones who actually came up with the categories for the clinical diagnosis for RSS. So it's been very, very helpful, I know, to a lot of families, because the genetic testing, there's only two known genes and one that is a potential gene that RSS shows up in. And so those who get tested, there's only like a 15% chance of it coming back with a genetic match for RSS. Simply because they don't know what all genes are involved. And so to have an ability to diagnose them clinically without that genetic component I know has been helpful to a lot of families and even to us, because it has helped us to get the help that we need for our children without having to wait for a time when, you know, genetic tests might, you know, when we could get the information on those genes that it is involved in all of the RSS cases. Mm-hmm. So that's Magic Foundation. I believe it's .org. Not 100% sure.
Yeah, I looked it up as you mentioned it. So we'll definitely include that in the show notes. It is magicfoundation.org.
Yeah. And they have a Facebook group as well. They're a very friendly group. They're very nice, very helpful. I know I've gone on there a couple times and asked questions. You do have to, like most of the specific groups for situations like this, you have to answer some questions or, you know, make sure that you're not just going in there to troll people, which is unfortunate that they even have to do that. But it's a good group, and they're very, very helpful and very, very nice about helping out people who need the help. Like I said, I feel like we have a very good team around us that's helping with Katie and helping make sure that we're navigating this well. And I really think my experiences with Alex have helped me to be the advocate that I need to be for her. Because, you know, I scheduled her to have an evaluation when she aged out of First Steps. You know, I didn't have to be reminded to do that. I went and I did the scheduling of that. And I talked to her pediatrician. Is like, I need a referral sent here so we can get this on the ball, because she's going to age out at 3. And her pediatrician was like, yep, not a problem. Send a referral in. So I think without the experience of Alex, and even to a certain extent, my oldest daughter, because she had had some speech therapy. And then, because she was in the NICU, she was evaluated by their therapists, at the hospital. After she graduated, after she got out of the NICU, they evaluated her just to make sure she was on track. And, if I hadn't had that experience of having those situations of needing to be evaluated and get them tested, and I don't think I would have known to, oh, I need to go and I need to do this. Mm-hmm. So it's very helpful. But I do know that groups like Magic Foundation are very helpful for those who may not have had the experience as I have, which thankfully are a lot of people. I'm glad that not more people have gone through what I have, because that I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But for those who don't have that experience, Magic Foundation is a great help and a great resource. And I really recommend people look into them, because they deal with not just RSS and SGA, that's their primary focus, but they deal really with any growth related disorder or syndrome.
What else should I be asking you about?
In general, I would say that that Katie is, or our most RSS kiddos have, you will run into some developmental issues, like I said earlier. I know with Katie, we just recently got I had her speech therapist ask one of the physical therapists that work with her to take a look at Katie, because I was noticing that she seemed to be, her feet seemed to be turning inward, over pronating. Mm-hmm. And so I mentioned it to the speech therapist, who mentioned it to the physical therapist, because Katie no longer is in physical therapy. And so the physical therapist took a look at it and was like, yeah, this is something I'm seeing. So we're going to try the easy route of shoe inserts to try to see if we can correct it. But that's something that, again, kiddos that have RSS or growth disorder, they a lot of times are going to have either uneven growth I know that, sometimes asymmetrical growth of legs or arms can happen, or they could end up with, and again, in Katie's case and in RSS kiddos' cases, it's because of low muscle tone, they could end up having those overpronation issues where they just, they tend to walk on the insides of their feet. It's something I would just recommend for anybody, whether it's a growth issue or whether it's some other genetic issue that's going on with your kids, is just, you know your kid the best, and don't be afraid to talk to the medical team that you're working with and say, hey, look, I'm noticing this. Can we do something about it? Can we figure out what's going on? Because I don't know. I'm not trained in this. I am just knowing my child, and I know what's right and what's wrong. And because honestly, the only reason I figured out with Katie that she was overpronating is because she was running off ahead of me, and I saw her as she was running, and it looked like her feet were going sideways while her knees were straight up and down. And I was like, that's not a right way to walk. Mm-hmm. So because I recognized that that was a little off, I was able to bring it up and get the help that I needed. So don't be afraid to talk to your pediatrician or talk to the other doctors or staff that's involved with the care of your child, because even if you don't have the training to know 100%, you do know when something seems a little off. And it never hurts to bring it up, because the worst thing that could happen is they could do testing, they could check it out, and it turns out that it's nothing. And honestly, is that really the worst thing? Mm-hmm. So for your peace of mind and for your child's safety and health and being the best that they can be, bring it up. That's what the doctors are there for. And if it turns out to be nothing, great. But if it is something, you've caught it. Same thing with, you know, the whole reason that we figured out that she was having the shallow breathing while sleeping was because I was concerned about her legs being growing unevenly, which led to an x-ray, which led to realizing she swallowed pennies, which led to me staying up all night with her so that, you know, she wasn't sick, mm-hmm. which led me to realizing that, oh, there are periods of time when I'm not seeing or feeling her breathing, which led to a sleep study, you know, so like it compounded, but it all started because I was like, are her legs growing at the same rate? Which I knew was an issue with RSS kiddos. And I don't say this lightly, because Dr. Google sometimes is not your friend, but don't be afraid to look into doing some research. However, a caveat of that would be, make sure you're getting it from a reputable site. Don't just go to any website and take what they say. I know Mayo Clinic has put out a lot of medical information out there recently that's good information. And I know they always say, check with your doctor if you're concerned. So don't be afraid to look under Mayo Clinic or look up information about specific situations if you're concerned or if you have a concern, because that's going to give you the information that you can go to your doctor with and say, hey, look, this is what I'm seeing. This is why I think this is going on. And whether or not it is, at least the doctor knows that, oh, you've actually put some thought into this. It's not just you being a worrywart or a hypochondriac or whatever.
Yeah. It gives a starting point.
Right. Right. And I know that at least the doctors that I've been involved with, when I have come armed with that information, for instance, when she was with the vasopharyngeal insufficiency, her speech therapist noticed it first. But when I went to the ear, nose, and throat doctor, and I said, here is our concern. Can you please, you know, can you do something about this? Can you put in a referral so we can see and deal with this? You know, she, the nurse practitioner who works for that particular ENT was just like, sure. Ran through a couple of verbal tests with her and was like, yep, I'd say that's a a VPI and she wrote the referral. And so me coming in armed with that, knowing what it is, knowing that the speech therapist was behind me and seeing it as well, that helped because it put some oomph behind my idea behind this. And I just think that most doctors are going to, if you're not going in there every single week and bringing up issues, if you're coming in there and being like, okay, this is what I'm seeing, this is why I'm concerned, most doctors I've dealt with are fine with that. And they are really, really willing to listen to you and hear you out. Obviously not every doctor, but most doctors are okay with that because they like having that starting point, because otherwise they're kind of shooting in the dark. And that's,
you're bringing them information. Like, you've been able to observe your child for thousands of hours and they're getting like less than an hour.
Right. Right. Unless it's something big, like Katie's growth being so small, most doctors in the period of time that they're going to see you are not going to have that information, as much information as you. And so you're going to be able to come in better equipped to bring it up and say, these are the reasons. And I don't do this myself, and I should. I'm very bad about it. But if you can, take notes. You know, if you see something concerning, write it down. You know, date it, time, you know, put the time on it, date it, whatever, so that you can go in and you can say, okay, I've been seeing this for this amount of time, and I've been seeing it this frequently in this amount of time. Because again, that's showing that you're actually taking it seriously. You're not just going in as a worry wart mom or dad to the doctor and saying, this, there's something wrong with my child, but I don't know what it is. It's, look, I've noticed these things going on. This is how often I've seen it. And again, that really helps, because if you go in and you say, I've seen it every day for 4 weeks, the doctor is going to be able to be like, oh yeah, there's something going on there. You know, versus if you go in and you're like, well, I may have seen it, but I don't know. Again, I'm really bad about it. I don't take notes nearly as often as what I should, much to my husband's chagrin. But it is something that I strive to do better at, because it is really helpful when you go in to see those doctors to be like, have all your information and have it right there so that you can tell them about it. Without having to think back and possibly get some information wrong. Because wrong information can be just as bad as not giving them the information in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. I think most of us don't really prepare for doctor's appointments in a way that would be helpful. And I mean, I know I don't, and I should know better. You know, if they ask a question and instead of saying, well, I think maybe it was around, I could look it up. If you're ready with the answer, it's a better use of everyone's time.
Right.
Like you get more value out of your appointment.
Right. Well, and something that, again, I don't do this as often as what I should. Or what I tell people they should. But if you know a doctor appointment is coming, write questions, like, because you're not going to think of them as you're sitting there in your appointment. So if you have a question about, say, you know, for instance, with Katie's going to be having a pre-op appointment here soon. And so one of the questions that I want to ask is, okay, after the surgery, when can she get back into the speech therapy? Not only for myself, but also so I can pass it on to her speech therapist so that they can be aware of when they're going to see her again. And if I don't write that down, there's every possibility that by the time I get to that appointment, I'm not going to remember to ask that question. And then I'm going to be sitting there like, oh yeah, I was supposed to ask that. Oh. And then I'm really bad about also calling afterwards to follow up with questions because I don't want to annoy people. So, So it's one of those situations of, really, if you have questions and you know you're going to have questions, write them down. Now, it could be that as you're sitting there in your meeting, the doctor's going to go over them anyway. But if he or she doesn't, then you're at least able to have that list of questions and say, okay, I had a question about this. Can you answer it? Okay. And go down the line. And then also gives you a place to write the answers in, because again, you're not going to remember. You don't remember what's going to happen in the doctor's appointments. our memories are faulty, and not remembering what a doctor said, the specifics of what a doctor said, is very, very common. And another part of that is make sure somebody's with you when you go into a doctor's appointment, because again, you're going to remember certain things about what the doctor said that another person is going to remember something else. It kind of goes back to the perspective I talked about with Alex, that, you know, people have different perspectives of what's going on. And so having two or more of, you know, having one other or two more people in the room with you to kind of hear what's going on and kind of relay the information back to you, and, you know, all of you sharing it together will then help you get a clearer picture of overall what's happening. So I, again, I wish I could say I did that all the time, but I don't. But I do recommend people doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Oh, not a problem. I'm glad I was able to. I love talking about my experience and Alex and Katie's experiences that she's going through. Just because the more information I can get out to people, I think the better people are going to be prepared. Even if it's not 100% the exact same situation I've gone through, at least it's maybe something they can glean something from that information and use it to their advantage. So I'm glad that you were able to, you were able and willing to talk to me and hear my story. And
my conversation with Jill was recorded in June of 2021. Before publishing this episode, we reached out to Jill for an update. Katie's palate lengthening surgery went well, and her speech has improved. Her diagnosis of velopharyngeal insufficiency led to genetic testing, and she was found to have a deletion on the long arm of chromosome 22. She was diagnosed with 22q deletion syndrome, also known by other names, including velocardiofacial syndrome and DeGeorge syndrome. The diagnosis of a 22q deletion made sense of all her issues. Congenital heart disease is common in individuals with 22q deletions, and Katie is now also followed by a cardiologist. So far, Katie has been seen to have some differences with her heart that aren't expected to cause any issues for her. Katie has also been diagnosed with ADHD and ODD, or oppositional defiance disorder. Jill attributes the ODD to her speech issues and expects it may resolve as her speech continues to improve. Katie is now 7 years old and in second grade. She is in the American Heritage Girls Scouting Organization and in tap dance classes and is loving both. Patient Stories is an ad-free podcast and is unaffiliated with any genetic testing laboratories. We would like to keep it that way. To support the podcast with a donation, visit graygenetics.com/podcast/donate. If you would like to dig deeper into the professional issues raised by these patient stories, for $5 a month, you can join the Patient Stories Club. To sign up, look for the link in the podcast notes for this episode or visit graygenetics.com/podcast.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.